This just in, hot off the bench press. Planet Fitness has added new strength equipment. Save $28 or more when you join today, and you can be one of the first to try it out. We're raising the bar with new benches, and our new hack squat will have you actually looking forward to leg day. Plus, we're still repping all of the best-in-class equipment we've always had, with most clubs open 24 hours, so you can work out your way on your time. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 10th. See home club for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Into Punk Classics, a show where we take old episodes of Turned Into Punk that have been lost from the internet and return them to their previous glory by sticking them back on the feed. You can find this podcast on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and all other forms of social media. Well, that's pretty much it. At Turned Into Punk, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamien. I play in a band. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy another TOAP classic. All right, Meredith, thank you so much for sitting down with me today.
Hi.
This is awesome. You're now in my record room. This is the first time when Danko Jones, I did the interview with him, I had to do it in the bedroom because Lauren had to do work in here. Oh. So this is the first time I've always wanted to do an interview in my room surrounded by records.
This is so... There's so much to look at.
This is like a monument to not a lot of social time as a young person, and as an adult now too.
This is how I would feel if someone looked in my closet and saw the sheer volume of dresses that I own. It's like the same. I feel very similar.
Well, I guess like that's the thing is like you have to find comfort in your distractions.
If I'm having a bad day, I could sit cross-legged on the floor in front of my closet and just look. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen my clothes in like 4 months because I've been on tour. So when I'm freaking out, I can close my eyes and like mentally thumb through all of the incredible dresses I have that span like the 1910s to the 1970s. And I can like see the fabric in my head and it just brings me this insane comfort.
It's weird because like, you know what, like I'm...
You alphabetize your records.
Well, yeah, exactly.
You said that to me.
The way you're talking about it is the exact same way I feel about these records when I'm on tour.
Oh, yeah.
Like I picture them and it's like... I think it's like the difference between like there are two types of people in this world, travelers and nesters. I'm a nester. Like
yeah,
I always
but
just
we
want
travel.
To be. Yeah. I'm not meant for this lifestyle.
See, I love it. Honestly, I will complain as much as any other touring musician complains, but like at the end of the day, I know for a fact that I am doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. If I can survive, you know how there's some plants you don't have to, I'm also a big gardening nerd. And I love succulents because they don't take too much care in keeping. I honestly feel like I have a kinship with those plants. I don't need a lot. I can own 6 things and live in a van for 14 months at a time. And I still wake up in the morning, even on 4 hours of sleep, I show up and I'm just like, all right, where are we going today? This is awesome. And it never gets old. I've been touring on and off since I was 19 and it never gets old. I know that this is what I want to do for the rest of my life, but there are days when what I need to get through is thinking about, you know, when I get home and after I have a good night's sleep, what shoes am I going to wear first? What of all? Because I have a fantastic collection of combat boots. I have amazing shoes because my feet are bigger than the average dude's.
So what's that shoe you wear?
I would wear like a men's 8.5 or 9.
That's a big shoe.
Yeah, I have bigger feet than 3/5 of my band.
I'm a size 13.
So, well, you're a wall of...
Yeah, but you know what the good thing about us is?
You're a scary big human.
You and me can always find cool shoes because
they're underpicked.
They're underpicked for us, you know? So that's a great thing about having big feet. I've never had a problem with it. I'm like, there's always a size 13 in the discount rack.
I can pick the dude section, so that's why I end up looking like David Bowie half the time. Well, I have some crazy shoes.
That's an amazing vibe to have.
It is.
No one's ever like, David Bowie, that guy that was so tacky.
I'm so bored of David Bowie.
Yeah, like, he's it's weird when you look back and even look at the parts where you know he was tacky. You look at, and he still doesn't look tacky.
You know what? Tacky is a class issue.
That's true.
Tacky is a class issue. Like, classy is a class issue. I don't play those games.
No.
I wear what I want. Every day is Halloween. And I've been like that since I was 12.
That's like your ministry coming out.
That is part of growing up. That was when I realized, I don't know, man, I always wanted to look punk growing up, and I never looked punk. No matter what I did, I never looked punk. I could wear bondage pants, and I would always look more like a fashion student. It never looked right on me. But when I was 14 and I had my first... Everyone has that person that, like, drags them to shows. Everyone has that first person that kind of saves them and introduces them. Mine was the girl who, the first time I met her, she was wearing a hat in school.
Well, okay, actually, I want to jump all into this because we got distracted. I want to start with the first question that leads into this. This is now, like, really lame, and this is why when you look around, you see all the records organized by country. I just want to have the question of, so how did you get into punk? Because I started them all off the same way.
I have two Genesis stories, and one was how I started listening to punk, and one was how I got into, like...
Well, both of them, like, what happened first?
They're different. I was born with a punk parent.
Oh.
I have a punk rock dad. My dad is cool as fuck. He's the coolest person that's ever lived. Every time, I always say it this way, I always tell this way, he reminds me now... Because I love my dad, and we had not a great relationship during my adolescence because I was a shithead. We are best friends now, and I always will tell now. Like, I will call my dad and say, like, hey, this website wrote this crazy article about me. They made all these crazy assumptions. It's super awesome. Like, I'm going to email it to you, and you should read it. Like, I'm so cool. Look at this cool article somebody wrote about me. I'm having a great day because someone said something nice about me. And his response will be like, I bet you think you're very punk, but I need to remind you that I painted your nursery listening to Husker Du. Okay, Dad. So my dad grew up in a small town and kind of, like, by hook or by crook, forced access to alternative forms of music. And, like, growing up in northern New York and growing up in, like, rural communities, wherever he ended up living with his parents, because he's an only child, grew up, went through his adolescence listening to punk rock, early punk rock, and jazz. And so the first music that I heard in my house, the first records, the first three records I remember hearing were Chuck Berry, Miles Davis, and The Clash. And when I was young, my living room looked like this room that we're in right now. Mm-hmm. I never was denied access to music. My dad had thousands of records. He had thousands of cassettes. And he had CDs when CDs were just starting. And so growing up, I assumed that everyone's living room was just... He's a TV news journalist, is what he does, too. He never went to college. He was always a journalist. He worked in radio. He was a photographer. He started working in TV. And during my childhood, he was a television news reporter. So every night at 5 o'clock, I would sit down in front of the TV and watch my dad. And then 6 o'clock would roll around and I'd wait 15 minutes and he'd walk in the door.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a weird way to grow up. Every night he would come home from work. Some nights he would bring me magazines. A lot of the time that was Rolling Stone and Spin. And some nights he would come home and we would put on a CD immediately and dance. And when I was 5, 6 years old, the song that we would often put on and dance around the house to was Train in Vain by The Clash. Mm-hmm. And so that stuck out in my head. That was like my childhood, was dancing to punk rock records with my dad.
I kind of grew up the same way. Like my dad wasn't a TV journalist or anything, but
it's a weird way to grow up. It is.
I did have records everywhere. And I feel it's like, that's an immense privilege because you really do get like a kind of jump on not falling into the pitfalls of terrible adolescent music, which of course we all end up falling into later.
Oh yeah.
But like, you know, you'd feel like at least you have that base level. Like I grew up listening to Ian Dury. So I'm like,
yeah,
I've got that, you know, in the same sort of way.
The flip side of that for me though, honestly, like I can be like, yes, my dad was very cool. My dad, and everyone will say like, yes, it is a privilege. You were raised listening to John Coltrane and Mingus. Like that is neat. Tell us more about your wonderful childhood. The flip side of that is that my mother was an actress. My dad was like a broadcast. He wasn't an anchor. He was like a beat reporter.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be on the scene. He was like low-ranking beat reporter. And my mom was a musical theater actress. So the other thing that I grew up with, on one hand, it was like the Ramones. And on the other hand, it was Cats.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was on stage. And so I had one parent that was constantly introducing me to like really far out music for a 6 year old. And on the other hand, I was in a dressing room with my mom and her two best friends who were drag queens doing a production of South Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
So I started performing on stage when I was 5. So I grew up listening to punk rock and doing like choreography. There's never been a time in my life when I wasn't actively investigating new music and actively being on stage and performing. So I literally had the weirdest childhood.
So it's all like, you know,
it's all I've ever done.
Well, we've talked about this before. Like everything has been leading to this.
I've been rehearsing for 26 years to be in this stupid band.
That's awesome.
You saw us last night. You see, the sound guy came up after and was like, this is going to sound weird, but do you have a background in performance? And I'm like, yeah.
But I do too. I did school plays. I did a lot of I was in the drama club. I did all that kind of stuff too. I think, you know, there's that. Have you seen The Feel from the Fury, the Sex Pistols documentary that Julian Temple did?
I must have years ago. I know I have seen it, but it's been a while.
I love it. Like, I love that movie. But there's this part where John Lydon's talking about his inspiration, right. And it's a Richard III performance, and I'm. Yeah. Laurence Olivier, that's Richard III? No, I can't. People are like, idiot.
We've had 4 hours of sleep.
Yeah, exactly.
We've been up,
like, you know,
we left after the show at like 3 in the morning.
3 in the morning. I got home. I woke Lauren up, my wife, at like 8 in the morning. And I'm like, Meredith's going to be here at 9. Actually, truth zone, she woke me up at 8 o'clock in the morning. Like, what time is Meredith coming here for the interview? And I'm like, 9. She's like, you got to get out of bed and get ready now.
I love also knowing other responsible adults that are still going to punk shows, though, because we went home at 3 in the morning because we were standing around talking to people, where everyone else around us was like partying. You and I were like, let's catch up with every single person before we leave the room.
Yeah, but I think that's...
It was cute.
It's so weird because, like, I don't get to do that too often. Now that's I have the kids out of town. So, like, when I was there at the show, I'm like, yeah, let's chat. Let's do this. Who wants to start a zine?
How many new bands are we going to see? Yeah. You want to stand around and talk about ballet for a while?
But anyway, he talks about how Richard III was his main inspiration for John Lydon, you know? And you see that kind of like there is that performance tradition running through punk rock.
I mean, I've joked a million times about, people have asked me about like, when our band first started to play, people were like, what you do on stage is so weird. Who are your inspirations? And they wanted me to say other singers. And I'm like, Jenny Holzer and Marina Abramovic are my inspirations. Kathy Acker is my inspiration. Like, I'm not looking to other vocalists to ensconce and explain what I do on stage. I'm looking at Tracy Emin. Like, I'm not looking at musicians. I'm looking at, like, feminist text artists from the 80s. So, I mean, which... Add it to the list of reasons why people think I'm a pretentious ass and, like, justify hating me.
No.
It's, like, a very real thing.
No, but hey, I'm glad you said what they were, because I was like, man, now I know how people feel when I start talking about some of these punk records.
You know, the Sex Pistols thing, I've always had a really big soft spot for that Sid Vicious My Way performance.
Mm-hmm.
That is real. That, for someone who grew up doing theater on big stages like that, that is real. We played, like, a month after people started to give a shit about us, because we wrote and recorded our record that's been out for like less than a year now in a week.
Wow.
We went from 0 to 100 in 1 week. And when I say a week, I mean like 7 days over the span of a month, maybe less. We went from writing and recording it. We literally did it on the fly. All of my vocals, except for 2 takes, were done in 1 take. We just did it and went. That's why the record is so simple. That's why it's so like moronic at some points. And then like less than a month later, we're at NYU. In the Kimmel Center on this colossal stage with Ceremony and White Lung.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked out on stage in this like Audrey Hepburn dress and red lipstick. And there's these immense red curtains. And all I could think of was Sid Vicious doing My Way. Like that's how it felt. It's, you just have to own it.
Yeah.
And that's that interstice between like punk and theater. It's cool.
What like, so, you know, you talk about recording that demo and how, you know, it's probably because you were holding that in. For your whole life waiting to get that out.
Yeah, I know we were talking the other day about how I went to shows for like 10 years before I was even in
the
band. Yeah,
so what was growing up with it, with your father playing you the Clash, and how does it get from that to being where you're the vocalist?
Investigating new music constantly my whole life, even stuff like mainstream radio rap and like getting really into that, and like growing up in the late 90s, being 12 in 1999 and having NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys, and like this, when I thought of the Clash and the Sex Pistols and Bad Brains as boy bands,
like, yeah.
Those were the groups of boys that I was into, and there was Backstreet Boys, and I had to be into that because I was an adolescent girl and I wanted to fit in.
It's kind of forced on you, I imagine, as at a certain level, like by peers, like being forced
on you. It's Ken Doll sexuality.
Yeah.
it's imagining everyone's molded silicone parts. It's like nothing, you know. And this is something really interesting, because that woman I was telling you about, who's this amazing music writer in New York, who's super into punk and hardcore, writes about boy bands a ton because mm-hmm. she likes to analyze cultural instances of sexual agency in teenage girls, where they're in control of their own sexuality and they choose who they sexualize. Well, so that's a real thing.
And you know about the youth of the day. Connection to New Kids on the Block, mm-hmm. where he's wearing the Youth of Today shirt in the video and stuff. Yep. So it's amazing. Like, there is a punk rock connection to boy bands, too.
And even Henry Rollins being on the cover of gay magazines in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like, modeling. The sexualization of and the masculine sexuality of hardcore is, like, another...
Oh, yeah, no, we could... Because Tesco V did like, you know, beefcake photos, yeah. gay beefcake photos back
and
in the 80s,
all the bands too. Right now that are using BDSM imagery.
Oh, yeah.
So many bands right now that are, like... into this thing where they want to get, even if it's only for show, which I'm always very suspicious. I'm always the person that's like, oh, this must be really fun for you. Bands that want to make art and videos about, like, having their balls stepped on. I'm like, when did this happen? This is amazing.
I went to a bar in Toronto and I walked in and there's a guitar player from this band, like not a punk band, but he's right. like strapped up being whipped. And I'm like, wow, this is like, this gives a whole new take to their music.
Well, it's like the Tampa hardcore kids that go dancing at that goth club, The Castle, where there's live sex shows.
Yeah.
And there's like guys, like elderly men in lingerie on the dance floor, like slow dancing to Jesus and Mary Chain. It's amazing. I'll only ever go dancing if I'm in Tampa. And
well, that was like
that place.
We had Vaseline in Toronto, which was Will Monroe, who passed away, his night. And it was like an amazing queer dance night. And he would have Limp Wrist play. He'd have... I think Wayne Jane County or Jane County played, over the years. And then also like DJs, and it was like a real kind of like, you know, for, especially like Mike, the guitarist in my band, like being that kind of like, you know, unsexualized, hardcore kid where your whole thing is to try and strip yourself of all sexuality. Oh, yeah. And then to go to like something like that, that's just, you know, not sexually repressive anyway, but totally sexually free.
Right.
It's like, the blind, you know, like we talked the other day, the analogy of the cave, you know, being like...
Yeah, right. You think you know everything.
You think you know everything.
And there's such an interesting idea there where there's like, on one hand, there's a huge component of the punk scene that's very about talking about sexuality, mm-hmm. and very about talking about gender. I was talking with one of the people who was working the show last night, and they and I were talking about... the idea of if you're like my age, if you're in your late 20s, early 30s, and the last 5 years alone, the conversation about people's gender, people's sexuality has come to the forefront of hardcore in a lot of ways. And it's incredible to see people finally being given agency after growing up feeling very repressed. Now, or ignored, or violated, or harassed mm-hmm. because of your sexuality or because of your gender. There's that side to sexuality in the punk scene, and that is... amazing. It can only get better, I think. It's good, but obviously we have to keep fighting for what we need for increased visibility and increased agency. However, the flip side of that coin is the shaved head chain wallet dudes, like the chain wallet, like boot boys who grew up, you know, the skinny nerds in the back of the classroom who are the macho dudes of hardcore, who are appropriating BDSM imagery and making this really interesting art about like leather.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fucking funny too. Mm-hmm. I think that's awesome. I think it's exploratory, and I think it's strange, and it makes me really happy. It makes me really happy to see images of like tough guys in hoods like getting pegged. I think it's awesome. I think it's so funny. I love it. I back it.
Pegging's gonna be the next big youth crew trend.
You know what? I went through that years ago.
With pegging youth crew?
Let me be the first to tell you, I was on that. No, that's a very complicated story that a lot of people besides me could tell you. never mind.
So you're at 12 years old, 1999, you know, you're in the throes of sort of boy band mania, which was
right.
sweeping the world. It's funny, too, because, like, you know, not to get off topic again, which we will keep doing, I'm sure.
I have this crazy feeling we will. Yeah.
But, you know, it's almost like young women are encouraged to get into music at a younger age, like before young boys in our culture are encouraged to get into music. But then it's almost like it's taken away at a certain point.
It
you
is,
know?
Especially in punk.
Absolutely.
It's easier for dudes to get into punk.
Oh, but I think that's where sure. men are kind of encouraged, at that point to kind of find music. It's like 14, in their early teenage years, that's when they're encouraged to kind of find their genre and, right. and stake their claim to a genre.
Girls are encouraged to
Sorry, find... that's my brother calling me on my phone.
Oh, you should take it if you have to.
No, I should have turned it off. Look.
That's why I'm glad I'm in Canada where my phone doesn't even work.
I'm trying.
Kind of awesome. That's why being in Europe is great. I know you hate touring in Europe, but
We're gonna edit this whole thing out. No, I don't. I love it.
Everyone hates touring in Europe.
No! You're exposing everyone. No.
Because it's hard to be far away from
exactly.
Home. It's hard to be far from home. It's hard to be. You know, I was talking about this with some people recently, and I said the hardest thing about touring in Europe for me, I'm a loner. I'm like a very dedicated loner. I'm very much like. I have people in my life that I love. I'm extremely friendly and I'm very, very social, but I prefer to spend most of my time alone. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I realized about myself a couple of years ago. It has been the most liberating self-discovery I have ever made, realizing that I almost felt like I had to do like a coming out thing. Like I had to come out as being a completely isolated like loner because I just don't need much socialization to be happy. In Europe, when I am with the same, I am head over heels in love with the dudes in my band. The dudes in my band are the greatest people on the planet. I love them like they are an extension of my body.
But a van can be an incubator of hatred.
When you're in Europe and you can't speak the language, you're in Poland.
And you're very isolated because you're forced to kind of just stick together
at that
point.
We've been on tour for 12 months straight. We have played more shows this year than there are days in a year, I'm pretty sure, because of festivals where we play three times in one day. Mm-hmm. We are a touring machine. All we do is tour. It's the dream. I love it more than anything in the world. These guys are probably ready to kill me at this point. I'm hard to tour with. I'm a monster. I say that. It's not really true. I'm actually awesome. Just saying.
Well, coming from another monster to tour with, you're awesome.
I'm fucking awesome. I love to make sure that people are fed and people are drunk and people are comfortable and people are warm and like people have called their parents to check in. I'm a camp counselor. That's all I am. I'm a glorified camp counselor. But I love taking care of people. So I'm actually probably totally fine to tour with. I self-monsterize. But when you are in Europe, the thing is, you are in situations where if touring in the United States is insular and the van becomes the hotbox of hatred, in Europe it's even worse because you are, by virtue of your surroundings, often forced to cling to your bandmates mm-hmm. as a life preserver. Mm-hmm. You are alone. You want to talk to one person who is not your bandmate. And by the time, because of the time difference, because by the time your friends are on their lunch break at work and have a moment to text you back, you are getting on stage. 7-hour time difference, it will break your heart. You walk around for 2 weeks with it taking, what a luxury. We have the internet at all. It's not the Pony Express. Letters don't have to be delivered by ship. Wonderful. But it still takes 12 hours for your friend to text you back.
Well, that's the thing.
And if you need to talk to somebody, if there's someone you love, even if it's not someone you love, even if it's business related, I have a record label now. I'm just starting to do my own label. And the band whose record I'm putting out first, which is an amazing, amazing record, by the way.
What are they called?
They're a band called So Stressed from Sacramento. They're from Sacramento. If I need to talk to them and I'm in Iceland.
Yeah, that's like what?
They're in California.
10-hour difference?
Yeah. And I feel like I'm screwing somebody over because I can't take care of them when they need to be taken care of.
Yeah.
And all I really want to do in life is take care of people.
Well, how do they do it before? You know, like, you look at these bands,
oh
it's like...
Oh, my God.
Even, like, sitting in a van, like, talk about... Like, sometimes you gotta put on those headphones and just tune everyone else out.
Oh, trust me, that is a concept I'm intimately familiar with.
Imagine if Ginn and Rollins had headphones, maybe they wouldn't be...
I don't want to fucking talk about Greg Ginn.
No, we don't have to talk.
He's a garbage piece of shit, motherfucker. You can send him off to his island with a one-way ticket. He should be blown out of a cannon.
This is we should...
And you don't have to edit that out.
No, I will not.
I hate trash fucking men. I could run down a laundry list. I need to add that to my article. I'm doing that article, 2014, the year of the violent entitled male asshole.
Oh.
Where, do you have... Even in the last 2 months, there have been so many instances of just garbage piece of shit motherfucker dudes in music. Horrific things.
Well, you know where you were in Canada. We had like the media self destruction to end all media self destructions this year when we had Jean Gomeshi.
That kinda, motherfucker.
Yeah, that was.
Okay, I'm gonna write this down really quick while we're talking. It's because I have a list in my phone. I have a note on my phone. I also have a video of your cat trying to eat my hair, which is really
Mr. Pickles.
Mr. Pickles tried to eat me. Put that. Don't edit that out either.
Mr. Pickles is the. He is the most affectionate member of the animal kingdom. I think, and you got to experience Mr. Pickles' full love in all its glory.
Yeah, that Jean Gomeshi, right?
Yeah, Jean Gomeshi, yeah.
He, what a piece of What a colossal piece of shit.
It's weird because, like, I'm...
Bill Cosby, Greg Ginn, Eminem, Ariel Pink, Marilyn Manson. Give me a bigger list. The same year of Gamergate, the same year of the Elliot Rodgers slaughter. What the fuck is going on with your side of the species? Send him off to a fucking island, man. This year was a mess.
Oh, it's absolutely...
It was a goddamn mess. And people... Then Time Magazine says they're going to ban the word feminism. You all get your own fucking island now. See you later.
But it's almost like you need, like, to be completely callous about it, but it's almost like you need this moment to happen historically, because all this shit's existed for centuries, and now it's just, now we can talk about
it. I have a friend who calls it the Day of Reckoning.
It's pretty, yeah.
And she feels it's on the way. This is what happened within the alt-lit community when Tao Lin got outed as a fucking rape. Let's sit down, all of us collectively, and make a list of every public figure this year, every male public figure involved in the creative arts, from Bill Cosby to Tao Lin. And let's make a list of how, let's make a PowerPoint that everyone in the world can access for free on the internet of everything these motherfuckers did.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put them on blast. Honestly, I am so fucking sick of this. Every day we find out another guy made a rape music video. Every day we found out another guy has been drugging and raping women for 40 years with zero consequences. We find out a guy wrote a novel about a woman he sexually assaulted when she was 16, and the thing is still in print. There are no more excuses. I am done. I'm old and tired.
I think celebrity makes these... It's a hyper-entitlement for men. You know, it's like, it's any, and it's not celebrity on like a giant celebrity level. It's on any level. Like, the attention is almost like, it's like it intensifies the entitlement to, well.
Our attachment to their work does not justify their sex crimes.
No, but I look back and going to the Warped Tour as a young person and some of the stuff that you witnessed back going on backstage and some of these festivals. And it's like, wow, when all this stuff starts coming out, it's going to be a really bleak picture for pop culture.
In Syracuse this year, we had Curtis Lepore, who used to be the singer of that shitty fucking band Ghost Ship. That shitty, shitty, shitty Syracuse straight edge band. Just garbage.
I was going to be like, like, weird, because I have a Ghost Ship. There's honestly a UK 7-inch by a band called Ghost Ship.
Yeah, there's a UK Ghost Ship too, but there's a Syracuse straight edge band called Ghost Ship that used to be around. The singer was this guy named Curtis Lepore, who went to LA because he got famous on the social media network Vine.
Okay.
There was an article in Rolling Stone about he fell in love very publicly on social media with another woman who was deeply involved in, like, the Vine community, which, you know me and social media, I've had a Twitter for a month. It's fun. I don't extend to, like, making funny videos of my dogs. He raped her.
Whoa.
He raped her, and she went to the police, and he tried to smear her, and they, like, settled out of court. There was a huge article in Rolling Stone about it, so... Trust me. And he was the singer of a straight-edge hardcore band walking around talking about all of his morals. And then he goes to L.A. and rapes someone and ends up more famous for that than anything he did on social media.
Mm-hmm.
Add him to the list. Put him in the PowerPoint. Ship him to the island. Fuck that guy. Mm-hmm. Fuck Curtis Lepore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the community I come from, and that community links Curtis Lepore with Tao Lin, with Bill Cosby, with Eminem talking about raping that loser white rapper from Australia. Like, whatever. Like, everyone is complicit in this. Put them on blast, Day of Reckoning. I'm calling it. Like, 2015 is the year, hopefully, that everyone collectively wises up and says... Like, I said to a friend of mine in New York the other night, I was out with a friend having a glass of wine before we went to see Deaf Heaven, and he's a music editor, and I looked at him and I just said, when do we stop talking about things in terms of this precious imaginary journalistic integrity where you feel like you have to report something as, you know, such and such man... announces, I'm so over this culture of not naming names. Ariel Pink calls Grimes a retard. That's a headline, first of all. You think that's important enough to make into a news article? Man harasses woman.
But
what a novel news article. And then what happens is they report it as, in an article, Ariel Pink was mad about something that Grimes said about him, and so he called her a retard. And that is the entire article. And nobody is willing, like, I don't care about your journalistic integrity. There comes a point where you are obligate to be like, and that is wrong, and he is a moron, and you should probably reconsider listening to his music unless you feel like you're at a point in your life where you can openly support a guy who says that stuff about a woman artist who's 800 times more successful than you anyway. Like, what have we come to where we privilege not expressing our feelings about shit like that when we all know shit like that is wrong? If you don't know shit like that is wrong, you shouldn't be reporting on it.
I think a lot of it is not wanting to rock the boat. you know, and like not wanting to be the first one to say, you know, which is awesome that you're the person who does, you know.
Because it rocks the boat for me when someone gets to call Grimes a retard and gets away with it.
Absolutely. But like, I think on another level, these people are at a point where they're, you know, you don't want to be the person who says this is wrong, you know. And I've been in situations where I didn't want to be the person that said this is wrong, you know, on a much smaller level. Where I've been like, you know, at a hardcore show and you see a band say something on stage, you know, or something when you're younger.
Oh, God. There's that band Self Defense Family. They used to be End of a Year. And it's funny because I always liked that band. I really always liked
Were they a lot. Someone in End of a Year, weren't they in Police Line?
Probably.
Way back when?
I mean, probably. I think, I don't know.
Or maybe that's... I love Police Line, so...
We're doing that thing we're talking about where we have to admit we don't know something. But it's funny because I liked End of a Year. They used to play Syracuse a lot. And I would go see them. I've seen them a handful of times. And for some reason, the singer of that band fields a ton of questions on his, like, Tumblr page where people ask him how he feels about me. And I don't think... I finally emailed the guy out of the blue. Well, no, because they played in Philly. And I got so sick of people coming up to me and being like, singer of Self Defense Family thinks you're a fucking dork. And I'm like, I don't know this guy, so let's talk. It turns out it wasn't even true. He like never said anything about that. So fine, nice enough guy. They did a show in Philly that my friend Will booked. And so I had seen Will that morning. We had played there the night before. And I said, how about this? We were at a restaurant and I took a pen and a napkin. And I'm like, dear singer of Self Defense Family, my name is Meredith. Apparently you've said some things about me recently. I don't know you at all, but I've seen your band a bunch. If you get this note, like, do me a favor and email me and let's talk about this. Whatever. And so I emailed him and I don't remember how we got on the subject, but I ended up remembering that when I had seen them at the Westcott Community Center in Syracuse, he's very infamous. He's an amazing lyricist and a wonderful, wonderful front person. He is a powerful front person. He's very good.
Were they on Revelation Records?
I don't know.
Shit, no, I'm sorry. I'm just hung up on this police. Were they from Albany?
I don't know. I will sit here and talk about this band forever in the context of the three times I saw them in a record of theirs that I know, and I will know nothing contextually about them, just because, like, this is why. Because when I saw them, he's very famous, he's a big talker, he's just like me, he'll go off in between songs, and he gives a speech about how hardcore is incredible, hardcore is amazing, the community that hardcore has afforded him has saved his life, he loves his bandmates, everything's wonderful, for 5 minutes. And then the last thing he says is, but I would throw these guys under a bus. I would kill them all for the chance to spend one night fucking a beautiful woman. Bang. And they go into the song. And I walked out. I liked the band. I didn't walk out in like a fuck this, I'm walking out way. But I walked out because I'm like, this isn't fun anymore. That's my experience growing up at shows. Mm-hmm. 14 years old, sneaking. I was 14 and there was this crappy, crappy bar in my hometown. I grew up in Watertown, New York. Middle of nowhere army base. There is a bar called Shooties, probably the size of this room. Tiny, tiny bar, literally on the wrong side.
You mean this massive, sprawling room we're in
now? In your estate. In the fucked up estate.
It's radio. We can make it seem way bigger than it is. No, I'm just saying.
Hello.
I digress.
What a big room. This bar was literally on the wrong side of the tracks. Like, there were train tracks that you had to cross over to get there. And they would have 18 and over shows, and I would lie and tell them I was 16 when I was 14 to sneak into the 18 and up shows. So I would be like, I'm 16, but I won't try and drink. And like, I was like 14, 15 years old. I'd sneak into shows there all the time. And I have this clear memory of being 14 years old and there being a band, not the band that everyone knows by this name, but a band called Penetration. I want to say they were like a speed metal, but they were like a metal band, like a speed metal band.
Okay.
And they had a shirt with a pentagram on the front that said Penetration. And on the back in Jersey letters, it said, all women are cunts. And that, I remember being 14 or 15 years old and being like, this is bad. Mm-hmm. This is bad. I don't remember being afraid of it. I don't remember it stopping me from wanting to go to shows. But I remember that memory rings like a bell. Every time I have one of those experiences, I would throw my bandmates under the bus for the chance to fuck a beautiful woman. Mm-hmm. That sets off bells in my head of being 15 years old and seeing Penetration.
Well, and also because you're like, at that point, like I wasn't at the show, but you're probably, I'm assuming.
I was like 22.
Because I've been to a lot of hardcore shows. But you're probably one of the few women there. I would say probably like, what, 10% of the audience, if that?
Yeah, in Syracuse, the women were and remain dramatically underrepresented in the
Absolutely.
But women remain dramatically underrepresented.
All over, right?
Syracuse felt after, like, we were talking a while ago.
But that's why, you know, sorry, not to cut you off, but, like, that's...
It's part of why, yes.
You know, that's, like part of why, yes. I cannot imagine wanting to stick around a scene where that's the kind of aggression you face.
But I did.
Yeah, well, no, that's...
I did want to stick around because it mattered more to me than the way men made me feel.
But then there's also, there are... You know, not every situation is like those situations. There are really positive things in
Absolutely.
Hardcore and punk. But, like, I can only imagine, you know, in being exposed to that as a woman, it must be very alienating.
This has been my experience since I started going to shows. Every time I go anywhere, there's a risk factor, and I have to assess it. And every non-male person that goes to shows goes through this moment where they assess the risk factor. The risk factor is like a spectrum. The lowest risk is that some guy's going to say something shitty to you. A band is going to say something offensive on stage and it's going to be stupid. Mm-hmm. Like any band that gets on stage and is like, there's a lot of hot ladies here tonight. Like, some dumb shit. Mm-hmm. Then there's people saying something legitimately offensive. Legitimately offensive. Then there's physical assault issues, just getting bashed around by dudes that, like, take up way too much space and have no boundaries. And it only escalates from there. Every time, if you're a non-male person, every time you go to a show, I've literally become so attuned to this practice. It is built into my spine. I do not think about it anymore. Even when I'm the person on stage, risk assessment. Sometimes, if the risk is too great, it will physically prevent you from going to a show.
Mm-hmm.
It's real. Like, if you know... And, okay, how about this? How about the risk inherent to the hardcore communities reluctant to kick out dudes that are shitty who everyone is friends with? I took 2 years off hardcore because people were still letting the person who habitually assaulted me for 2 years book shows at a venue.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about risk assessment. Like, and I can't tell you how many people I know have had the same experience where abusers are still allowed to participate, even when everyone knows, mm-hmm. because he does so much for the scene. He's everybody's friend. He's in a good band. This is not unique to me.
No.
This is the experience of countless people. When someone who is just a piece of shit is still allowed to participate based on the virtue of their contributions. And this is full circle back to the list of people that are being deported to Fuckboy Island. For real. Their art does something to people that makes it worth it for people to keep them around despite the fact that they've raped or assaulted or otherwise violated people. I don't want to live in that world. My desire to participate in hardcore supersedes my feelings about that. It is a constant balance and a constant matter of risk assessment. And that's been my life since I was 14.
And I know this is like a lot of this is my privilege, but like I find it bizarre that like I've written off Woody Allen. Like I will not watch a Woody Allen movie, but I still will listen to, well, Zelig I loved.
I watched Annie Hall recently.
Well, really? You don't like
I realize he shouldn't. He just should never have been allowed to write female characters.
Well, yeah, he definitely. So awkward. He definitely writes an awkward female character too. That's why Zelig's awesome because it's about just it's a documentary-ish thing about him. But now I can't watch it. I'll still listen to a Gigi Allen song. You know?
And the band that was playing with Penetration that night at Shooties was the Murder Junkies.
Oh, really?
The Murder Junkies loved my hometown. They would be going to play with like Blood Wolf and Buffalo or something, and they would always stop at Shooties.
Was it like Wimpy from The Queer singing at that point?
I don't even remember.
It was
Dino and Merle Allen.
Yeah.
And so I would see the Murder Junkies twice a year.
Yeah.
There were so few shows in our hometown. This is what we were talking about the other day, about growing up in small towns where there just aren't shows. And if you don't have access, the sacrifices you make as a non-male, like non-normative, non-gender-conforming person at 14 or 15 years old, going to a bar to see the Murder Junkies in the middle of the night, even if my parents didn't know
exactly... As a 35-year-old man, I would have trepidation about going to see the Murder Junkies in the 90s in the shitty bar.
My parents were not stoked on me going to shows. I remember my 16th birthday.
Understandably, if you're going to see the Murder Junkies, too.
My 16th birthday, my dad was like, I will take you to the show. I will drop you off a block away from the show so your friends don't know I'm dropping you off, but you need to know that I do not agree with this. And I'm wearing like a white Angora sweater and I have like fancy lipstick on because I'm like this little Marilyn Monroe looking high school punker. My dad drops me off at the show and I'm bouncing up there and I'm going to see the fucking Murder Junkies.
Wow.
Like that was me at 16 hanging out with this. I had this boyfriend, this funny boy. All my friends went to other schools. This was this thing in this small town system where like in the school district where I went to high school, my mom is now the principal of my old high school, but at the time she was like an English teacher, and she only became a teacher. She stopped doing theater and started teaching when I was like 13. So she like raged quit Bohemia in a very real way and got a real job.
And mainstreamed.
Is now badass. Like, she went from zero to the principal of the high school in like 10 years. My mom is
awesome.
My mom is the penultimate bad bitch. She's very, very smart. And now she has students who know her daughter's in a band, which is great, meaning she hates it. But she's awesome. And,
So you go on that Murder Junkies show.
And she absolutely hated it. And so, like, she's the principal of the one high school in our school district. And then there's these other rural districts around where I grew up in Watertown. There's Carthage, New York. And there's like, Lyme School District. And there's, like, really little school districts with one high school each. Every high school had, like, four punks.
Yeah.
Everyone knew each other. So one Saturday a month, one of those towns would have a show at the VFW.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, like, people were in bands. There was this band, I think they were called, like, Social Suicide, you know.
Oh, I think I have a Social Suicide.
Not the same Social Suicide. In small towns, kids would literally just not know. So there would be a band called Social Suicide.
I guess it's also pre-Google. So
I told you about this. We were on dial-up internet.
Yeah, yeah. In the middle of nowhere. You have an excuse. It's not like now when you hear about a band, you're like, how do you not know there's a band
called
X-Ray Specs?
There three bands in the last 10 years called Skaters.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So there was a band, Social Suicide. We would go out, and it was this kid Ricky and this kid Drew, who's they're both amazing guys, and they were like legendary because they had record collections, you know. And then from their town, there was this boy named Simon, who was from Italy, who I was in love with because he was just this doofy, like leather vest and no shirt, this fucking macho guy. And he was friends with like the guys in the Murder Junkies. He was 16 years old, and I would go out to this small town, Carthage, to go to this bar that would have all ages shows once a month to see Social Suicide, and I'd go to Simon's house, and Simon would show up at my parents' house to pick me up for shows in his dad's car with his pants. He got chubby, so his pants didn't fit, and so he'd just leave the fly undone, and his pubes would be hanging out, and he'd have this belt buckled over it, and he was really fucking gross, like really gross. He smelled really bad, and I was in love with him, and I'd go to his house, and he'd be laying on his bed, listening to a record with these colossal headphones on, and I'd have to fucking kick him to wake him up. I'm like 16. And I'd go, Simon, we gotta go to the show. What are you listening to? And he'd look at me and go, Noam Chomsky. And like, those were the small town punks when I was growing up. We had nothing. Like, so we would branch out. And it lent well to us having this colossal diversity of interests.
Mm-hmm.
So we would be listening to Noam Chomsky lectures before we'd go to the Murder Junkies show.
So is that what kept you around? Was it like the fact that you knew there's got to be something more to this than the Murder Junkies and the penetration?
Yeah, because I was also, you know, I had girlfriends, which I lucked out. And this was how I got into going to shows in the first place, was I was in the small school district, one middle school, one junior high, one high school. And when I was in junior high coming up to high school, I was at an award ceremony. I was getting like an art award, and there was this girl that was sitting in the back who was wearing a hat in school, which was not allowed, of course, and had dyed black hair, which I had never seen, cut real fucked up with like safety scissors. And she had a corduroy skirt on, and she had taken white paint. And I will never forget this as long. I will take this to the grave, if I'm lucky. She had painted Lydia Lunch across her skirt with white paint. And she started talking to me. And that girl turned out to be my best friend for most of high school. But she was 2 years older than me. So she graduated at the start of my junior year. And I felt like I'd had a limb amputated. Her name was Anna. Anna had a car. Anna had a death wish. She smoked cigarettes and hung out with men in their 30s and went to shows and had other girlfriends that did the same thing. And because of Anna had the key to the door that I had been locked behind my entire life. Anna saved my life. Anna made me who I am. When I was 13 turning 14, Anna was 16 turning 17, and so were all of her friends. They were all girls. They introduced me to Riot Girl. They introduced me to how to make a mixtape, you know, which is something I had known from my dad, but like how to really find the good stuff. They introduced me to how to cut and dye my own hair. They took me to the Salvation Army. They taught me how to dress. We all looked like we wanted to be Thora Birch in Ghost World. We all looked like little grandmas. And that was like, when I was 14 years old, that was when people were into emo. And this is something I openly fessed up to you the other day, is that I was very into emo when I was that age. I liked Mineral. I loved Mineral. I loved Mineral and Jimmy Eat World.
That's my brother's favorite band, Mineral.
Yeah. Mineral's
They have that
amazing
one song, ND. It's about, he wrote for his brother. That's like the one of the most beautiful songs ever.
And Serenading will never not be a perfect record. We were into The Promise Ring. We were into Mineral. We were into
Braid.
We were into everything. I loved Braid.
I fucking loved Braid.
Framing Canvas.
Yeah.
So good.
Braid's the one emo band, like from that period of emo that I kind of like still listen to. And I'm like,
yeah, I stand
this
hard
is
for
awesome.
Braid. I loved that band. We were into that. And we were also into like, the weird. I mean, they had been listening to Bikini Kill, so they were over it.
Mm-hmm.
And I never was that like ultra fan. I've been misquoted a couple times as being like, Bikini Kill saved my life. When really what I meant was like, being introduced to music made by women, by other women, saved my life. Mm-hmm. Like, that was what... But I was into Huggy Bear.
Yeah.
I was super into Huggy Bear. I was into, like...
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Remember that band Cadillaca?
No.
Cadillaca. Oh my god. I liked
because... Was it with a K?
No, with a C. Cadillaca was a life changer. We were into a little bit of twee stuff too, so we were really into... We were these cadre of really awkward girls that like cut our own hair and like would go to the Salvation Army and get these t-shirts from the little boys section that had like dinosaurs on the front. Mm-hmm. And we'd wear them with these dumpy corduroy skirts and these grandma ass Hiracha sandals. And we'd wear like slouchy berets and big clunky sunglasses. And we just looked like little grandmas. And our favorite bands were like Go Sailor and the Dangerous Birds. And we'd listen to like ironic weirdo rap music like Tigra and Bunny.
Mm-hmm.
And like we would make each other these elaborate, we were in love with each other. We had this amazing relationship where like we'd go out in the world, we'd go to these like waste case 30-year-old poet dudes apartments and like lean out the window and smoke cigarettes very self-consciously, and then we'd all pile back into Anna's early 80s pastel blue Mercedes Benz and drive around listening to Songs Ohio and like smoking. We'd drive down to the res and buy the bags, the Ziploc bags of cigarettes that were really cheap. Mm-hmm. And we would drive around smoking cigarettes and listening to these tapes. And then we'd go home and like really self-consciously, I'm affecting a voice I just realized because this was me at 14. This was me. I was very serious.
We all are at 14.
We would go home and make each other these really elaborate, like two set mixtapes with like EVOL era Sonic Youth, like Shadow of a Doubt, which is why I'm using that voice, you know, like that we were in love with each other. I got a guitar. I started playing guitar when I was 12. By the time I was 14, I was writing songs for these girls. I was in love with them. They were older than me, though. I was different. I was little Meredith because I was sneaking into shows that they could get into because they had been going to that bar for 2 years. They knew the bouncer. They didn't have to lie anymore. I did. I was new. They changed me. They made me the person who I am today. They did. Those girls. Anna and all of her friends.
Do you see any of them all anymore?
Anna is a military wife in El Paso, Texas.
It's weird how life takes you different places.
We lost touch for a long time. Well, she was a painter. That was the thing about her. She was a painter in the vein of Alice Neal and Modigliani. She was very into Alice Neal and Modigliani. Her best friend, who was... ended up being... Because there was this weird... There were also weird love triangles among us because we were all queer. So there would be weird love triangles. And I ended up dating her best friend for a while, having this torrid love affair before said friend went off to college. And said friend introduced me to Patti Smith and Diane Arbus and, like, far-out, really emotional, really dark what I would call like femme emo stuff, femme emo artists and femme emo music. And that was like my great love affair when I was in high school, was with that person. Anna went to Moore College in Philadelphia, where she became a fantastic painter and lived this wonderful, miraculous life, and painted these nudes in the vein of Alice Neal and Modigliani, and also introduced me to painting as a concept. She really got me to start investigating art, which is something that, I mean, with my parents being so into music and my father being a writer and my mother becoming an English teacher, I had also written since I was about 5 years old. So music and writing were my two things. Anna got me into art.
Do you find getting into punk freeing for writing too? Because like that's what I think. Punk is like the place that it's okay to write. Even like I'm super self-conscious about how I write, and I love the fact that I could put a zine out. And punk, it was okay.
Punk and writing, they weren't the same thing for me for a long time, but I did grow up loving that. But my friends who were into punk were photographers. The one person was a photographer, which is how I got into Diane Arbus, and Anna was a painter.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up seeing punk as a way to... Punk was like a blanket that wrapped around your other art. Mm-hmm. Like you were, for the first time, there was a qualifier there. And, you know, it wasn't, at the time, I never remember it being gendered, but that's probably because most of my friends were female or, like, non-male people. I don't remember female painter.
Mm-hmm.
I remember punk.
Punk painter.
Punk painter. I remember Anna being a punk, like a punk that did oil paintings. That was insane to me because I grew up, you know, in these small towns. I got into it, my dad being a journalist and my dad also being a punk, he would have a copy of In the Fascist Bathroom sitting around. He would have England's Dreaming. He would have Please Don't Kill Me. And then by virtue of that, I found out about like Kickboy Face, you know, and then I started getting into zines. Through music journalism, I knew what a lot of bands were. I knew the history of bands I'd never heard. I had read about Black Flag. I had read about Bad Brains. I had read about, you know, the early 80s hardcore before I ever heard those bands. I read about X before I ever heard X because my dad had books and I was still young enough that like stuff about drugs or stuff that was offensive wasn't always accessible to me.
I think also like that was the time too where, you know, you could read about something and not be able to hear it because you just wouldn't have access to that. Yeah. If you read about something, you know, you're like a click away from checking it out.
Usually you're reading about it in the context of hearing it.
Yeah, true.
Music blogs.
True.
But again, I feel so weird doing this. Is such like my get off my lawn, you crazy kids. I had dial up internet moment, but like.
But I think it's not that because it's a paradigm shift, right? Like that was a huge moment for all culture.
This is why when I was 14, I was getting mixtapes from these girls, is because we were in a small town. We had dial up internet. I couldn't download music until I was like, download music in a way that was like easy until I was like 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So another thing that those women introduced me to that was extraordinarily formative to my development as a person, like an active pursuer of alternative and underground music, was them introducing me to the early forms of social media for punks. There were websites back then. There was LiveJournal.
Yep.
I met a woman at our show last night who came up to me and said, "This might sound strange, but I was reading your LiveJournal in 2004.
Lauren was a huge LiveJournal person.
I was a huge LiveJournal person. And there are people that see the band now that are like, I read your LiveJournal when you were 14. Huge music sharing communities in the early days of file sharing websites like YouSendIt were how I found out about the Jesus Lizard through LiveJournal. Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
Huge for me. Butthole Surfers, LiveJournal bands, dead serious. Outside of that, because those were the early music sharing communities for me, were private communities on LiveJournal where you would upload a record. You'd upload like a Poison Idea record and you'd write like Poison Idea bitrate, 8 tracks, track listing. This is what it sounds like. In return, I want. And you'd put up a list of records that you want. And if somebody had them, they would download your Poison Idea record and then they would burn and they'd rip and upload a CD.
Yeah.
I have a friend who lives in L.A. named Ross.
Ross from Ceremony?
No, I know him too, but this is my friend Rossiel Cuevas.
Okay. I'm like this one Ross.
I met him because of him sharing Swan's records on a LiveJournal community when we were 14.
That's awesome.
We are still friends. We talk every few days. He comes to all of our shows in the L.A. area. This is someone that will be my friend for the rest of my life. We met on a LiveJournal file sharing community.
Mm-hmm.
There are people in my life now who I have known for upwards of 12 or 14 years that I'm still friends with because of fucking LiveJournal. It is amazing.
I bet no one on Makeout Club's saying that.
And that was my next point, was Makeout Club and those websites.
Yeah.
Anna introduced me to Makeout Club. Makeout Club and Lipstick Party were the two social networking websites for people that were into punk and emo in like 2001 to 2004.
Yeah, that was like Gibby from Panic, who did MakeoutClub.com, must be like kicking himself.
They didn't sell
it for millions and millions of dollars.
Makeout Club was revolutionary for me because that was older kids that wanted to like talk to each other. I was like 14 and I was never like cool on the website, but what I would do, this was back when everyone was super emo and everyone's pictures were really, you know, you can see it in your head. It was pretty funny.
Yeah, I never was on it, but I would be lying if I said we didn't go on it and lurk it and see who we knew
Hell
that was
yeah,
on it.
Fucking cute ass people were on it. You'd go and look at babes all day. No, on dial up when the pictures took forever to look.
You'd read your friend's profile on there and you'd be like, that's not what you're like in real life.
The first line of the profile would be like a list of activities that the person or authors the person would like. So it would be like Chaucer, knitting, bicycles, quote from Hunter S. Thompson, and then the line on
American Nightmare
would be American Nightmare, Seisha, Blood Brothers, Chick Chick Chick, like all the bands you were into, and then there'd be like the weirdo black metal guys on it too. Those websites were the first time I saw people identifying and expecting other people to understand their personality through the music they listened to and the books they read.
Mm-hmm.
Revolutionary for me because grew up in a small town where not a lot of people gave a shit about the stuff I liked. I saw that Makeout Club and websites like that and LiveJournal were a portal for me to a world where I wouldn't be alone as a person that chose to identify a large part of my personality because of the music I listened to. Dial-up internet, Makeout Club, Napster. And what was the other one? LimeWire? The green one.
LimeWire.
The green one.
That was the one you could use with Mac.
Yes, and
I'm a
dedicated Mac user because my dad is a big computer nerd too. You would go on Makeout Club and you would write down the names of bands that you thought were interesting and you would download whatever you could find.
Yeah.
And more often than not, on dial-up internet, you could only get one song.
Mm-hmm.
So I had one song by Amanda Woodward, that French screamo band. Fell in love, started to investigate international screamo bands, found out about bands like La Quiete, started looking into like different kinds of music, found out about the Blood Brothers. Blood Brothers, hugely formative band for me, one of my all-time favorite bands ever, ever, ever to this day. Saw them on their last tour. I know they're like doing reunion shows now, but I haven't made it out to any of them.
Fucked up, played with them one time, but it was on the tour I had a nervous breakdown before and didn't go on in Europe. The first time they went to Europe, they wanted a different singer. And fucked up, played with the Blood Brothers. I never got to see them. Everyone says they were fucking crazy.
And it's funny that I love them so much. Because now I find myself in this awkward position where I'm in a band where the vocals and the frenetic, like, violent, complicated style of music has polarized people.
Mm-hmm.
So growing at age 14 when Burn Piano... I was 14 when Burn Piano Island Burn came out, and that record changed my life. Blood Brothers made it okay for someone to front a violent, noisy, hardcore band who couldn't, quote-unquote, really sing. People with weird voices, people that weren't doing that Youth of Today bark, that weren't doing that, like, 80s style.
There were other bands, but I think the Blood Brothers were definitely the band that brought that to a larger audience.
Blood Brothers were current.
Yeah.
Blood Brothers were accessible. Mm. I remember going to the tiny, tiny mall in my hometown and finding Burn Piano.
Which is something that's, like, I've never heard an argument for Hot Topic, but that would be an argument for stores like Hot Topic, is making the gateways to those cultures accessible to people that don't have cool record stores.
People that want to shit talk Hot Topic, people that want to shit talk commercial punk rock.
Mm-hmm.
There's enough to shit talk about commercial punk rock. That douchebag from NoFX just kicked somebody in the head on stage a couple weeks ago.
He did, believe me, Fat Mike and I, long sorted weird history, but he did apologize to that kid. But I know what you're
it's
saying.
It's triggering as hell to have somebody manhandle you on stage, I understand, but you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I know,
it's
exactly. I know, and as
you apologize
people,
because you know what? I love this.
And did have the kid kick him in the nuts.
Go downstairs to your kitchen and pick up a plate and drop it on the floor and watch it shatter. Look at the plate and say, I'm sorry. Does the plate miraculously reform?
I'm not defending this anyone involved.
Saying, like,
but I will say, I think a NoFX fan being hit by Fat Mike is kind of like the highest honor they could have.
I think
because this kid, I was like, wow, he must be scared about lawsuits and all this kind of shit. Yeah. And then like the kid's like, thanks for the best night of my life, Mike. Oh, I'm sorry I grabbed you. God.
Yeah, it kind of become that kind of punk rock, that kind of Warped Tour punk rock has always felt more like WWE wrestling than music to me anyway.
It's weird because that
in terms of like persona,
that's my emo. Like when you talk about the music that when we were talking in the conversation, I'm a little bit older than you, but right. Like that was the music that I look back on in my youth. And I'm like,
I never listened to that stuff.
I think it's because it was the time.
I know NoFX song. I know Don't Call Me White. That's it.
It was the oh my God. Liberal Animation is a classic record, but
I don't know anything about it,
but they're, you know, and then, but there's, you know, obviously, oh my God. Some of the nights I've had with that dude is terrifying.
I don't know him. I don't know him.
You know what?
That's okay.
He's a nice enough
dude. I'm sure
he's
perfectly.
Yeah.
You know what? Everyone is nice.
But, yeah.
Everyone is nice.
Not everyone.
Most people are total pieces of shit. But.
I can think of some people, like, I know what you're saying, like, everyone's nice when you're talking about people in bands. You're like, oh, they're nice guys. They're nice band.
Everyone in a band has a common understanding on some level.
Yeah.
Even if they've somehow, by virtue of ego or delusion, surpassed it.
Yeah.
You can always, with enough elbow grease, you can bring people back to that mutual common ground.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are assholes. Well, yeah, it's unfortunate.
And I would say that's also people who come from a background in punk rock. That, not saying because everyone who comes from background in punk rock is a good person or decent person, but when you have that commonality of punk, you know, like I find like I'm in the weirdest situations sometimes with people, and then we start talking and we both make a connection with some random band.
But at the same time, it's different for me because for so many people, like, yeah, we were all at the same shows. Let's say me and all these people, we're all 16 years old, we're all at the same show. None of them have to deal with the all women are cunts shirt.
Yeah, it's a different interaction with
it. So like, yeah, we all grew up in the punk scene, hooray, you've never had to question a goddamn thing about why you're here.
I think there were certain, probably some of those people that knew it was wrong, didn't say anything, but knew deep down it was probably wrong.
Well,
But I know what you're saying. You're right. It's not.
I don't have time and energy at this point in my life for people that are complicit and don't question it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're my age, because I always talk about how old I feel. I always talk about how old I'm getting. I'm very obsessed with it. And my friends love to look at me and be like, please shut up now. I always tell people ask how old I am. I'm like, I'm almost 30. And then they're like, no, you're not. You're 27. You're not. I'm like, 27 is almost 30. I like to round up.
Enjoy those three last years.
You know what? I can't wait. Because there's a carbon half-life for women in hardcore, too. It is so unfriendly. It is so obnoxious. We have dealt with this for so long. Every single woman I know in hardcore has countless sob stories, stacks on stacks on stacks of stories about times that they have been violated, harassed, and annoyed by dudes. 9 out of 10 bands in the hardcore scene are all dudes. It's dudes everywhere you look. I don't care where you're from. I don't care if you're from the most feminist hardcore scene in the world. You're still surrounded by douchebag dudes because hardcore is a magnet for assholes. Even if you're in an awesome situation where you're in a feminist band and you're having a wonderful experience, you're still risk assessment oriented. Because hardcore is asshole dudes. We get tired. It gets exhausting. We get fed up. We either splinter off to other scenes and start making other kinds of music, or we just quit because we get sleepy. I took 2 years off. I wasn't in bands for a long time because of being mistreated by people that I had done bands and shows with for a couple of years at that point. I was a really active participant in a scene that rejected me when I came forward about abuse that I had experienced. It was awful. I took time off playing in bands. And then when I came back, I started this band.
So what brought you back? You know, like, was the music, just the music ultimately?
Honest answer, like real honest answer. I act like I've never said this before when in actuality it got me in tons of trouble. Blind fucking rage, being furious, waking up one day, having a long time to heal from some really horrible, horrible things that I had experienced at the hands of I dated another person in the hardcore scene. And this is why I feel like it's okay for me to talk about this, is because it was my experience, and even though I'm not always sure that I'm okay talking about it, I feel like I have an obligation to, because there are other people that have gone through this and are going through this currently that deserve to feel like they have space to talk about their experiences too. I was in a band with a person who I was also in a long-term romantic relationship with and did a lot of projects that were within the hardcore scene, who was terribly abusive. Emotionally abusive, sexually abusive, bad human being, and I was with him for a number of years. When we broke up, He continued to violate me. He power stalked me for the better part of a year. He moved to a different city in an attempt to escape what he had done. Was in bands out there, ended up attempting suicide on the phone with me. Horrible human being, absolutely rotten, had sexually assaulted other people in different cities. Absolute nightmare of a human being. This guy still owns a record store, is still in bands, is still touring. People, this is what I mean when I say there is a problem when people still voluntarily allow men who are known abusers to participate in the hardcore scene when it's already hard enough for women to just fucking show up. Mm-hmm. There have been people for years now writing about how this guy sexually assaulted them. I have made a record about it. And he is still... He tried to add me on Facebook yesterday. I have a Facebook now. He tried to friend me on fucking Facebook. I'm like, dude, I wrote a record about the fact that your repetitive sexual abuse of me made me quit punk for a year and got me kicked out of my community. Who do you think you are? Friending me on Facebook? And what do I see? Of course, I'm like... guilty as everybody else, so I look at his profile. Pictures of him at shows.
Yeah.
Women go to shows. Yeah. He shouldn't be allowed around women.
Well, you brought up, you're going to shows at 16, seeing Gigi Allen, the Murder Junkies. Yeah. I mean, not Gigi Allen, but they talk about that in Hated. Dino's a registered sex offender.
Terrifying.
For exposing himself to young women.
And I wouldn't have known.
No, exactly.
It's and just... I wouldn't have known. And I didn't have any other options. There are 15 and 16-year-old girls in the city where he lives, in the cities where he's lived, going to shows that look at this man, that buy records from this man. This man puts out records. This man owns a record store. He sings in bands that play all ages shows. He's a predator. And he's still allowed to participate. Mm-hmm. Why I hate hardcore, reason number 462, because I'm not alone. There are so many people out there that have stories of going to shows where their abuser is present, where their abuser is still allowed to participate. Like, knowing, having to be reminded of that yesterday. Yesterday. And you know what happens? He lives in a city that's very close to here. You know what happened? I was on stage last night, and I had to think about the reality of what would happen if he decided to show up. What happens when the man who systemically abused me in, like, extreme... Are you familiar with the term gaslighting?
Maybe not.
Gaslighting. Gaslighting is when someone else executes a certain amount of emotional control over you by convincing you that you are crazy.
Okay.
He does things to make you feel like everything is your fault. He convinces you to make... He convinces you that you are crazy, that you are the problem. The person who convinced me of that for years, the person who manipulated me emotionally and sexually and did terrible things, who ended up at the end of our relationship sleeping with my best friend who lived next door and did the same thing to her and ended up sexually manipulating her for the better part of a year, destroying the bond with one of the other. There are fucking five women in Syracuse going to hardcore shows at that point. She was my best friend. She was one of them. And he did the same thing to her in front of me to take down our friendship. So one of the only people, and she was one of the only people that knew what he was doing to me. She'd hear us screaming at each other through the wall. Then he did the same thing to her. He's a predator. He moved to another state, did the same thing to multiple people, tried to, he is a nightmare, literally a nightmare of a human being, movie monster level. And there was a possibility that he was going to come to our show last night. And the fact that he had tried to contact me again made me feel like there was a possibility that he was going to show up. Everyone knows he is a fucking creep. He still puts out records. He owns a hardcore specific record store. He's still in bands. I can't think of many other scenes, many other social scenes, many other music scenes off the top of my head in the world that nurture rapists.
I think, sadly, I think, you know, we look at what happens in mainstream media. You have a mainstream media that nurtures rapists, too.
And that's why I'm furious. And that's why I'm, like, gonna annex that island.
Yeah.
Real soon. Like, send him off. But
on a more, not to, you know, cut you off or anything.
Oh,
like
no,
that,
I will rant about this forever.
No, please, please feel free to. I do think you're such a positive force, and I'm not, this is part of the positivity that you're so open about this stuff. So I'm not trying to, you know, dismantle what you just talked about.
No, that's okay.
But at the same time,
it's got to be a dialogue. It can't just be me yelling.
No, I know, but like, what do I? Yeah, he sucks. Like, what do I say at that point?
Yeah, beyond, exactly.
You know, but you know
what usually happens at this point? If I'm talking to another woman, they'll say, "Let me tell you about my ex-boyfriend," yeah. And then I'll hear about how he went on tour and, you know, took naked pictures out of some girl's phone. Like, every time I talk to another woman about it, they say, "That's horrible. Let me tell you about my ex-boyfriend." There is not, I would hazard a guess that there are few women involved in punk and hardcore that don't have a story about a nightmarishly abusive cisgender male ex-partner.
But I think, and once again, not to, you know, take away from what you're saying, but I think also that's reflected, unfortunately, in all of society, right? Like, it's like, one in three women will be a victim of some sort of sexual violence in their lifetime.
And that's a pretty neutral thing. We need to start looking at those. I mean,
and there's also trans people too, you know, there's like, there's all that sort of stuff as well.
Look at the history and look at what those assaults lead to.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain demographics for whom the one in three, two in five, whatever statistic leads to date rape. There are, you know,
look at Canada where First Nations
where women are getting slaughtered.
Yeah, like that's a real thing. It's way more than one in three that will be a victim of some sort of.
There are lines of class. There are lines of race. There are intersectional lines on which our very safety is stretched.
And so let's say even one in three, even though we're both, I guess, acknowledging that it's probably
way
higher than probably one in three realistically. But let's say it is one in three, and that's just in all society. It's almost like this community is a microcosm for all the bullshit. Even though it's meant to be removed from all the bullshit in society, it can be a microcosm for all the bullshit in society.
There is nothing new in the world. We all learn our behavior from somewhere, and acting like the hardcore scene is so fucking radical and different is an absolute lie. The only people that... It's very, very hard if you're a participant in what I would call like an average hardcore scene to honestly believe that there's any chance of changing much of anything. And it seems honestly sometimes like the only communities that really have changed, the only communities where there really are people that are fighting against the status quo are people that have eradicated the norm of hardcore, which is like straight white dudes. Communities that have decentralized that as being the stereotype of a person that's into hardcore, communities that have become, to great benefit, more isolationist, communities that band together on the lines in which they are privileged and the lines in which they are oppressed, where they remove themselves from that status quo and kind of say, like, we're going to go make our hardcore scene over here.
Mm-hmm.
Places where that happens, those are the scenes that thrive. Also, fun fact, those are the scenes that produce the best fucking music.
For real,
like that's a very real thing. I think scenes that like sort of push against that white dude, like straight white dude, macho fucking thing. The best music comes from those scenes too. Mm. Absolutely.
The one thing that is, you know, punk and hardcore, as much as a microcosm for all the bullshit and sexual violence, obviously in the rest of society, it does give people a stage at certain points to address these issues. Like you've definitely done that, and that's the thing is like now there's a dialogue and you don't see that happening. Like Janice Dickinson, when she wrote her book talking about Bill Cosby raping her, it was laughed away, you know, whereas there are people within this community that do recognize, you know, there has to be a better way to this.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you're right. You're right. It is
so complicated.
It is very much like, you know, talking to people of color, people of different genders. It is, you know, even as a white hetero male, I know we are way overrepresented in this community, and this community really benefits if it isn't just us on stage yelling.
Yeah, but try telling them that.
Well, and I think it's honestly hard because I think it's hard because, you know, and it's coming from someone that's probably yelled down at people in different times, like myself. But I think when you hear that critique, you take that critique on and you're like, I'm not a misogynist.
Not all men.
But at the same time, you kind of are because you do permit the violence to happen.
Oh, God, of course. Neutrality is taking the side of the oppressor. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's like, that's the 101.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing worse than that is when these dudes get the 101 and feel like they've earned a get out of jail free card, where now the conversation is even more about them because now they're smart. Now they would never do anything oppressive. And so when they fuck up, which is alarmingly often, they say, I am so sorry that I have hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
I am so sorry. And then it becomes about their apology. There's like no middle ground with these dudes. And they, that's not exclusive to hardcore though. That's like every indie rock dude, every alt dude.
Every ever. Dude.
Every fucking dude. I'm like, no, because there's the not
that's me too. Camp, dude. That's me too. Like that's how I was when I finished women's studies. I think I really felt I had earned the right
you
to be
from
a misogynist.
Centering your privilege to centering your apology.
Well, yeah. Well, you also at that point are like, well, I know better. So when I do something, it's with full awareness that I know better. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it makes it better. Mm-hmm. You know. So you can start saying things. You know, you can start using language that you shouldn't be using. You know,
yeah,
language
we saw
that
some of that last night.
Yeah, unfortunately,
once you feel like you've had an education in a marginalized community,
yeah.
You get to say whatever fun words.
Yeah.
That language used to be referred to as fun words.
Well, that's what it, I think that's what it is. It's those are the words that you see it with your kids when you're like, you know, you don't say that. Don't say that. You can't say that word, you know, and with our kids, it's obviously not fuck because their dad has
sure.
already ruined that word for them. But, you know, it's like stupid and things like that. We don't want them to say to people.
Yeah,
hurt
of
word.
Course. Things that are hurtful.
But they want to say it because you're not supposed to say it. And I think that's the thing with these fun words. But the thing is, we're adults now, so we should know why you don't say these words. It's not just because it's a random collection of letters. You
it's
say them
because there's centuries of oppression
weight.
Backing them up. And if you want to privilege your right to say a fun word over someone else's humanity, you get a ticket to the island. I am riding this island before. I'm taking this one. I'm going with it. I believe in the island.
The island is, well, there'll be some quote-unquote good music on the island, I guess.
Yeah.
There'll be a lot of good people.
You know, do you know how many bands I love that have horrible people in them?
Oh, my God.
I am not perfect, man.
I know. It's hard.
I adore the music of some horrific people.
Well, that's the thing. Is like,
horrific people.
That's why I think I love older music so much, is because it's safe. You know? Like, I know all the horrible things that these people did, and I can compartmentalize it. There's no surprises, I should say. Like, you know, like when you listen to G.G. Allin, you've seen Hated. You know he's a horrible
it's
dude.
All there.
There's not, it's not like when you're like listening to the dude who does your morning show, who's always espousing sort of these like
right.
quote unquote liberal values, and that turns out to be this fucking psycho abuser.
John Gomesh.
Yeah. But that's what I mean. Like, there's no surprises in any of these.
Oh, Jesus.
You know, when you listen to that band that had that like horrible dude that did these horrible things.
There are surprises now, though. Surprise rapist is like really common.
Well, surprise.
Really
that's
common.
What I mean.
Surprise,
surprise rapist. But that's what I'm saying. Like, those are bands now that you get surprised by. Like,
you know what band
or, like,
I was
when
obsessed
a band lets
with,
you down. Now
I will say this: the biggest letdown of my life. God, that's the most overdramatic thing I've ever said. People are going to laugh so hard when they hear me say that. The biggest letdown of my life.
The first thing I had to give up on this podcast was realizing that there's some people that are going to laugh at the things I say. Because, like, when you're having a normal conversation, hyperbole comes up. You say the wrong phrase.
I am the most overdramatic motherfucker that's ever.
And without hyperbole, this world would be the most boring place on Earth.
It would be the worst world ever.
It would be the worst place on Earth.
It's literally the worst. Also, I've been swearing a lot, and my dad's going to listen to this and be like, like my parents. I got a tattoo. I let this felon stick and poke me in Brighton over the summer, and I have the words "don't swear" tattooed on the back of my wrist. So when I'm in an interview, I sit with my hands folded.
So you like don't swear.
And every time I look down, because I usually have a lot of trouble making eye contact with people. I am very awkward. I'm like really socially awkward. I mean it when I say that. It's part of the reason why I spend 90%+ of my time alone. I have "don't swear" tattooed across the back of my wrist for that reason.
It's funny, but you're in a room with a guy in a band called Fucked Up.
And I sing in a band called Perfect Pussy.
Yeah, Perfect Pussy.
Yeah,
we're both people that should not be worrying about that. But you do have to censor.
The band that I was in, I did not swear at all. This band, I dropped some serious words on that record. And if I had to do it over, that's the one thing I'd change.
Yeah, we don't.
I don't need to swear. Swearing is terrible. That's like the reason I don't like to do it, is because I am deeply, 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 deeply in debt from a degree from a university that proves that I know enough words that I don't need to swear. I will be buried with my head resting on a pillow of college debt.
Yeah.
At this point in my life. And it proves that piece of paper proves that I don't need to swear. And yet I do. And I delight in it. I relish it. I want to talk about all the motherfucking assholes on the island.
Yeah.
All the time. Oh my God, my mother didn't speak to me for a month when an interview ran with me very early on in this band's career, where the writer referenced the fact that I, instead of speaking a response to a question, I made the jerking off gesture. And my mother was like, "You are excommunicated. Goodbye." But it, like, I'm so sorry. I didn't have a word for that. I just had to, like, you know.
Well, as my parents were like, "What? How are we?" Childish. When fuck it became my job, they're like, "How are we supposed to tell people what you do for a living?"
Oh,
like,
my mom.
My dad was always cool with it, but my mom and stuff, and she now has come around. But it's like, how awesome is it, Mom, that I'm in a position where I can do whatever the fuck I want for a living?
There's a picture of me in Rolling Stone. I freaked out. I'm like Rolling Stone, yeah, but like there was a colossal picture of me in Rolling Stone. There was like 3/4 of a page. Me with like my hair looks great and I have very pretty makeup on and I'm wearing this bright red cocktail dress and I'm dancing in front of an audience. And I'm like, that is a singular experience, man. No matter how I feel about like mainstream music journalism, whatever, it was very early on in the band's career. Like, there is a 6-inch tall picture of me looking like Audrey Hepburn in Rolling Stone. And my mom was like, "You can see your armpit hair and the name of your band is Perfect Pussy. Why should I care about this?" And I'm like, "Mom,
but
please just be like, it's a nice picture. Like, just say something nice for once." But she's come around.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing is,
they're just happy I'm happy.
As a parent now, that's all I want for my kids is I want them to be happy. At the end of the day, and I want them to find somewhere where, you know, they can find a way to cut through whatever bullshit and find some sort of peace in it in some way, or find something, I don't know, aspirational in
Very curious to see what will happen to the children of today's punks.
Oh, yeah.
Because of that increase, even like I was talking to this person last night about, even in the last 5 years, the increased conversation around gender, the contemporary world relating to the sort of emergence of pop feminism, very interesting. People raising children of all genders, what will happen to the children, to our kids?
Mm-hmm.
What will happen to our kids? I've been thinking a lot lately. I'm 27 years old, and I come from a family with a long history of reproductive problems that goes back for generations. I'm starting to think about, like, do I ever want to have kids? I am a deranged lunatic that travels around the country screaming in people's faces about times that I've been hurt by men for a living. Should I have kids? Like, wow, this is the first time in my life that question's ever entered my head. Now, what would have to happen in my life that I would want to have children? Because this is part of to mm-hmm. kind of bring it full circle mm-hmm. and not make you feel like you just wasted an hour talking to someone who completely diverted from the purpose of your podcast.
No, but my inspiration for this podcast is a podcast by this guy Cole Cabana. He's a wrestler and interviews wrestlers, indie wrestlers.
You know, I love wrestling.
Really?
I love wrestling so much. I had a boyfriend in high school. I love wrestling from an ironic distance, which I'm embarrassed to admit, because I had a boyfriend in high school that wrote for Wrestle Crap.
Oh, really?
My high school sweetheart.
Was Artie?
No, you don't know everyone I'm dating.
I'm not trying
to guess who I'm dating.
And they got it wrong every single time. Wrestle Crap, I have a book written by the guy who writes Wrestle Crap downstairs.
Well, I had a boyfriend in high school that was obsessed with wrestling and would submit to Wrestle Crap. This was 10 years ago, you know. He loved wrestling. So I grew one of the other things. And this was a guy that I was in a band with when I was in high school. I played drums in his band. This was like, music and wrestling have a very close relationship in my life. They really do.
Punk and wrestling have historically huge connections.
I was talking about Mick Foley last night and talking about how his first book, his autobiography of his time in wrestling, where one of the last chapters is about his relationship with the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network
with
and his
Tori Amos.
With Tori Amos.
Yeah.
It should be required reading for dudes in hardcore. And how Tatum Brown is a brilliant fucking novel. I love Mick Foley. Mm-hmm. I love Mick Foley. I used to go to wrestling matches with this boyfriend of mine. Wrestling and hardcore have a very, very,
punk in general,
very interesting relationship.
The Dictators on their first album have like a wrestling theme and the guitar player. So the Dictators did a wrestling fanzine. The guy from Vom has written extensively about wrestling. Like, there's like a real
Ultraman is Black is in a fucking straight.
Ultraman is Black in a V. I got that record down there. Actually, I don't know. I'm not going to ruin his identity, but Ultraman is Black has a long history in punk and hardcore.
Oh yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Oh, I know.
I don't know if we can. I guess we shouldn't ruin his gimmick.
I used to follow very closely on Square of Opposition Records.
Okay.
In High Valley.
Yeah.
Which they are neighbors with Ultraman is Black.
Yeah.
And wonderful, wonderful.
And it's weird because like Piss Jeans, Brad from Piss Jeans, wrestled in Chikara Pro Wrestling.
Singer of Piss Jeans is the most interesting person on the planet to me. I'm really obsessed with him. I made a Twitter you know, because I bother you on Twitter. I made a Twitter like a month and a half
ago. I thought you were going to be like, I made a Twitter for him. I'm like, that's weird that you did
no,
that, Meredith.
You know, you know what? Don't steal my fire. He found me. And I have loved Piss Jeans for years and years and years and years and years. And now I like follow the singer of Piss Jeans. And he occasionally tweets about fashion.
Yeah.
And it makes me so happy. Like, I am weird. I'm weird as hell. I will decide from a distance of space and time who I want to be friends with, and I will seek them out. And when I meet that person, I am charming. I am creepy. I'm like BTK. I'm like a creepy, creepy person.
You and me are speaking the same language on this
podcast. When I want to meet a person, I will go in so hard. I will romance the shit out of them when I meet them. I will like make them want to be my friend. I feed people. I'm a really good baker. And I like love people's bands with like this burning intensity. So if I love your band and I meet you, I'm just going to like want to befriend the shit out of you. And if I ever meet the singer of Piss Jeans, I'm just going to be like, what will it take to get you to be my friend? Because you are a dyed-in-the-wool fucking weirdo.
Yeah.
And you tweet about mohair skirts.
And he was in...
Can we hang out?
I think he was in Ultimate Warriors.
Another Ultimate Warrior. I could go on and on and on.
Oh, the
on.
Warrior.
The Ultimate Warrior is one of the most interesting wrestlers. You know, he died this year.
You are, like, believe me, you are in the presence. This is like this whole punk facade that you see in front of
you. You're really just a wrestler. You look like a wrestler.
I'm hiding a wrestling. I hated wrestling in high school because I hated all the kids that liked it. It was the Attitude Era.
When I said I was ironically distanced from wrestling, it's because I never grew up with it.
Yeah,
my dad listened to Miles Davis. I didn't like fucking wrestling. Not that those two things are mutually exclusive, but in my dad's a pencil neck.
No, my dad didn't. Yeah, my dad might was an indoor dad.
He didn't. Yeah, I had an indoor dad.
You know, he wasn't
like he's a cat.
No, we did amazing stuff. We like listen to music. We would draw together and stuff like that. Like things I treasure. But he wasn't taking me to play soccer.
We were sitting in my house dancing to They Might Be Giants.
Yeah.
He did not introduce me to pro wrestling.
Yeah, he wasn't like, do you want to see Andre?
I got into wrestling through the guys I was friends with in high school.
See, that's when I got out of it. But I guess once again, like...
So I was a 16-year-old. Like, there are people that can validate this story. Mm-hmm. We went to see a match at the Carrier Dome in Syracuse. And I was living, you know, 3 hours north of there at the time. So we drove down. It was a big deal for me to go to this wrestling match. I think this would have either been my senior year of high school or my freshman year of college. So I was 16 or 17 years old. And we went to see a wrestling match at the Carrier Dome in Syracuse.
Was it WWE or...
You know, this is my ironic distance from wrestling. I don't know. But the wrestlers that you
yeah, I'll know the when wrestlers,
I tell you who's
yeah.
wrestling. So we're at the Carrier Dome and we are watching. We went because of Rob Van Dam.
Oh, yeah.
And Booker T.
Yeah, WWE.
WWE. Yeah. Okay, so we were at WWE at the Carrier Dome. And I go with a group of guys who all grew up watching wrestling. These are the guys that were into WrestleCraft. They were doing their wrestling thing, super into it. And I have two things in my bag. I have a Polaroid camera, which is another thing those punk girls I was friends with in high school got me into. They got me into, this is back when you could still buy Polaroids.
Yeah.
I used to take Polaroids of people. I was very, when I was 14, 15 years old, I had a wall of Polaroids in my bedroom.
Warholian.
I would take Polaroids of people at shows. I would shoot people in bands. I would shoot my friends. If I ever find those Polaroids, they're going to be amazing.
A book.
So I had a Polaroid camera. I had a Polaroid, like a 660. So it shot, it wasn't Spectra. It shot the regular film. And I had my knitting. And I've been knitting since I was like five. I like it. I'm not very good, but I like it. So we were at the wrestling show watching Rob Van Dam. And there are people in my life that can validate this. I was knitting. I'm watching like this really intense wrestling match. And everyone around me is screaming. I am cheering. I'm watching it. But I am knitting a scarf.
Yeah.
At a WWE match. And so after the show, the whole point of us going was that my high school sweetheart, he was going to pick his cousin up at the airport. And we have to wait. And we justified going to the match by the fact that we had to pick his cousin up flying in from God knows where. His cousin, side note, owned a retired Fancy Feast commercial cat.
Whoa.
He had this white Persian cat that he was in love with, and he had to leave the cat at home, and he would always get, he was like 45 or something.
He had to put gloves on and handle them, I think.
More or less. He had this beautiful, elderly, Fancy Feast cat. So he was flying out. We had to go pick him up at the airport. I had to have been 16 years old because I was just balls out weird. And we went to like Applebee's in North Syracuse, near where I had grown up. And all of a sudden, who walks into Applebee's but Rob Van Dam and Booker T in Hawaiian shirts and sweatpants.
Do they have fanny packs on? Because that's another thing wrestlers always wear.
And they sit on the... Punks love fanny packs, too. That's another punk.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Punks love
punk,
fanny packs.
You're right. The punk fanny pack
I was
connection.
Guilty of wearing fanny packs for a long time. They sit down on the other side of the restaurant, and all of the guys at the table are like, and they're freaking the fuck out. And I'm like, look, it's the wrestlers. And the guys are like, shut the fuck up. We got to go talk to them, but we can't interrupt their dinner. We can't do it. Oh my God. We can't. So finally we're sitting there and we're burning time.
Yeah.
We're waiting for someone to come in on a plane and they get up to leave. And I'm like, out of my way, motherfuckers. I jump up and I pull out my camera and I chase these two wrestlers outside. And I'm like, excuse me, Mr. Van Damme and Mr. T. Excuse me, my name is Meredith, and I have never been to a wrestling match before. And I saw you wrestle tonight, and I thought you were both very good. Mr. Booker T, you are terrifying. You are very tough. He was
a heel at that point, right?
Yes.
He's a bad guy?
Very much a heel. Yeah. He is a colossal man.
Yeah,
Rob Van Dam is shorter than I am.
But they're way wider in real life. When you see a wrestler, like you see one on TV, I find, and they're little, and then you see them in real life, they're huge.
Now, Rob Van Dam is shorter than I am.
Yeah, shorter.
But I'm also like 5'11". I'm very tall. Rob Van Dam is shorter than me. Booker T is like 6'4".
Yeah.
And he is a large man, humongous. So I chased Rob Van Dam and Booker T outside of an Applebee's in North Syracuse and said, I went to your wrestling match and I really liked it. And my boyfriend is the biggest wrestling fan and he's too scared to talk to you. And I was just wondering if I could take a picture of the two of you. I would really appreciate it. And I pull out this colossal Polaroid camera and Rob Van Dam and Booker T, honestly, I say this with absolutely no shred of dignity left in me. They looked at me like I was the most precious thing they'd ever seen in their life.
Well, Rob Van Dam was also probably pretty high.
They were so nice.
Yeah.
They were the nicest men I'd ever met. So Rob Van Dam does his like thumbs pointing pose and Booker
Rob
T does
Van Dam.
His like five thing.
Yeah.
And they've got their arms around each other, and I snap a Polaroid, and I hug them both, and
That's
I run back
awesome.
Into the restaurant, and I give the Polaroid to my boyfriend, and I say, you can, like, this is for you.
That's awesome.
He just, I don't really talk to him much anymore. He's still a musician. I saw him at South by Southwest very briefly this year. He actually just got married, which is funny. He's the first of my ex-boyfriends to, like, run off and get married. As far as I know, that Polaroid is still his prized possession.
That is awesome.
That is a real story. I knit my way through a WWE match and then took a Polaroid of Rob Van Dam and Booker T outside of an Applebee's in North Syracuse. That was my adolescence.
That is an amazing story.
That's my shit. That's my wrestling connection. So
well, we've gone to an hour and a half.
Jesus.
I could talk to you for another hour and a half, but you got to get on the road to Ottawa,
so
and I don't want to like do it right to your band shows up to pick you up. But well. Why don't we just end it here and then we can do this over Skype another time?
Anything you want. That was a lot.
This is a lot. No, this is awesome. And this is amazing. Thank you for sharing with us.
Two people that can talk forever should not.
Well,
or should.
That's the thing. Yeah. It's like there's a, a lot of commonality and not experience necessarily, but just like in sort of like relation to this music in ways, I think. And also wrestling apparently too. I was like,
and like 97 other things.
So, I guess I'll leave it at this for now because I want to talk more about the past year of your life.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about the band.
We didn't even get to Perfect Pussy.
I'm in a band, by the way.
Yeah, well, I think everyone will know that.
Maybe.
We'll establish that in the intro. But like,
maybe.
I found this with a lot of people that I've talked to is that you get kind of caught up in talking about your formative years because they play so much of a role in where you're at now.
I mean, I literally just pretty much explained the entire reason I'm in the band.
Yeah.
So there's the story. I mean, that's the story of me.
But also, like, the last year of your life
has been insane.
It's been crazy.
Unbelievable.
And we could do another podcast, you and me, just both talking about becoming hipster hardcore bands. The growing pains that go along with that. So why don't we do that for another episode?
Absolutely. I think a lot more people in the world need to hear me talk. That's definitely.
Well, hey. I thought that so much that I gave myself my own podcast.
Congratulations.
So,
hooray for you.
Well,
hooray
you know what?
You.
That's the thing about the podcast. It's the hooray for you medium.
Yeah. Hooray for you is a very real thing.
All of
hardcore is hooray for you.
Thank you so much for doing
that
this.
That was cool.
This was fucking awesome.
I just had to let your cat eat my hair and we're all
Now Mr. Pickles can come back in the room.
Mr. Pickles, come back.
This just in, hot off the bench press. Planet Fitness has added new strength equipment. Save $28 or more when you join today, and you can be one of the first to try it out. We're raising the bar with new benches, and our new hack squat will have you actually looking forward to leg day. Plus, we're still repping all of the best-in-class equipment we've always had, with most clubs open 24 hours, so you can work out your way on your time. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends January 10th. See home club for details.